Hello, welcome back to an episode of History Hack. You've got me and Merrin today. Very exciting. Love working with Merrin. But Merrin, you've got an interesting guest for us. Tell us who we got on.
I have another Alex for us to talk to. Alex, tell me how to pronounce your surname. Is it Christoffy or Christoffy?
It's Christoffy.
It's Alex Christoffy. And Alex is a writer, an editor, and an award-winning author who has written, how would we describe it? I know that you've described it yourself as burying your heart in Dostoevsky's fiction. What we're going to be doing is exploring how you've put the book together and why people should read it, because it gives some fascinating insights into that time, the time and the evolution of literature and how society and literature kind of worked in harmony. So, as a biography, Alex, do you want to take us into, I don't know, just exploring how the book is put together, because it's put together with anecdotes and interesting slants on his life, and perhaps tell us a bit about where we are and what's going on in the 1800s.
So I sort of decided to put this book together to explore kind of what it was like to be Dostoevsky. I think that there's been a lot of really, really good writing in the last few years about Dostoevsky's contribution to philosophy and to novels and to literature. But I also think he just as a human being, he had an absolutely fascinating life. And actually, the more you learn about his life, the more you realize that there are these little kind of pieces of his own life that have informed his fiction. And it really felt to me like there was an interesting thing you could do there. So I found this sort of way of chopping in bits of his letters, which of course people do for biographies, but also bits of his fiction. And other things in his writing that seemed kind of to throw a new light onto his life, to make it feel as personal as possible, I suppose. It, you know, he had an idea in his later life that he wanted to write a memoir, but he never got round to it. And I really like this idea of trying to sort of reconstruct in some way that kind of intimate feeling of a memoir.
It's a really, really good approach. Do you want to tell us a little bit about where he's living and what's going on there?
Yeah, it's also a fascinating time for Russian society because it's so he was born just a few years before the Decembrist revolt, which was in 1825, December 1825. There was a sort of succession crisis. The previous Tsar had died, and a new Tsar, Nicholas I, was going to come to the throne, and all of the nobility were convinced this was the moment for them to kind of rise up and. They decided this was the moment they were going to ask for sort of slightly more almost pro-democratic reforms, liberal reforms. One of the things they wanted to do was to liberate the serfs. You still had a sort of version of almost feudal society where the peasant class were kind of tied to a piece of land. If you sold the land, you sold the serfs. So it was a, you know, it wasn't quite the same as slavery it was practiced in the West, but in practice it was a kind of slavery. And a lot of the liberal nobles wanted to change that system. Nicholas I responded on the first day of his accession by rounding up about 36 cannons and firing them at the 3,000 nobles who had gathered in Senate Square. And his relationship with liberals, yeah, it wasn't great. It wasn't a great start to his leadership of the country, and he wasn't subsequently, as you might imagine, very fond of liberals. So that was the early part of his life. And when he, as he became an adult, there were some signs that maybe things might be getting a little bit more relaxed. But then, of course, there were these revolutions all across Europe in 1848, and that made the Tsar very worried for his position, and he kind of had a serious crackdown. So that was kind of the first half of Russia was overshadowed by that. The first half of Dostoevsky's life, Russia was overshadowed by the kind of trials and tribulations of Nicholas the First. And then in the second half, you had the Tsar was called the Tsar Liberator, Alexander the Second, who did make some steps to kind of reform the way that government worked and to free up the serfs. It wasn't it wasn't a sort of unmitigated success, unfortunately. And there were a lot of socialists and revolutionaries who had other designs on the Russian state. So it was a pretty turbulent period, but it was absolutely fascinating that this period that Dostoevsky lived through, 1821 to 1881, it's really the difference between a kind of feudal society and a society that's on the brink of, you know, discussing ideas around a communist revolution. Obviously, that didn't happen for a while yet, but the scene was already being set in the 80s.
So moving away from the idea of people as chattels and more into community and more into
absolutely
respect, more into respect for each other.
Yeah, huge disagreements over how to have and form a good community. But most of the people, even if they disagreed strongly with one another, they were all talking in really explicit terms about, you know, what makes a good society.
Exploring and it kind that of framework, yeah, exploring yeah. the ideas and pushing back, and that I think we'll come to this in a bit, but that comes to the idea of Dostoevsky himself actually looking at these ideas and surfacing them as options through his literature, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
I find this time period really interesting because the Russian Empire wasn't as stable. You've got uprisings, like, for example, in the Polish sector, Poland, I say that very liberally. You know, you've got uprisings happening left, right and centre, people wanting independence. And it is just such a mess.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was a what we would describe in 2021 as a hot mess. What's really weird about Dostoevsky's version of nationalism is that actually on paper he's almost exactly identical to the kind of views and beliefs of some of the Polish nationalists. The only difference is the Polish nationalists were working against the Russians and the Russians were you know trying to keep Poland as a sort of client state of the Russian Empire. So sadly, particularly Joseph Conrad's dad was a leading figure in the Polish nationalist movement, and they actually loved so many of the same things, but if you put them in a room they probably wouldn't have got on.
When do Poles and Russians ever get on?
Well, yes, that's probably a whole podcast right there.
Sorry, Marin.
It's all right, no problem at all. So let's have a look at Fyodor. Let's have a look at Fyodor himself and understand a bit about the family he was born into. Because then, what little I remember, he went through the Military Engineering Institute, so he could have had a very different career. Tell us a little bit about him as a person.
Yeah, his father was a surgeon, and he worked incredibly hard to basically get. He was awarded the lowest rung basically on the hereditary nobility. So he was like the 14th most important rung on the ladder when it came to the gentry. It basically all it conferred on you. It certainly wasn't respect, but it did allow you to own land. So they saved up all their money over the course of years and bought a tiny, tiny estate numbering 100 serfs. That's how the size of estates were counted in those days. If you for comparison, someone like Turgenev would have had literally thousands of serfs on his estate. So this, you know, they bought basically a kind of a barn with a bit of woodland attached.
A small holding with some people attached.
There was a sort of village, a hamlet nearby, but it was pretty down a hill. But Dostoevsky loved it and he spent a lot of time there. One of the running themes in Dostoevsky's life is that he was very, very unlucky, and that started early on. When he was about 10, this estate burned to the ground and never really recovered. His mother died when he was 15. And actually, after he was sent to this engineering academy that you mentioned in St. Petersburg, his father died. In the best case scenario is that he died of alcoholism. The worst case scenario is that he's potentially murdered by his serfs because he was deeply unpopular. He used to, he was very violent. He used to take serf girls into his household at far too young an age and was an all-round unpleasant man. So Dostoevsky kind of found himself basically orphaned in St. Petersburg, knowing he wanted to be a novelist, but sort of having just qualified as a military engineer. I mean, I think anyone who knows even a tiny bit about Dostoevsky is kind of would be terrified at the idea that he'd be an engineer. That there's a Russian lecturer in America called Erwin Weil who makes my favorite joke about Dostoevsky is like, who would want to walk across a bridge that Dostoevsky built, you know, if anyone's seen the way he plots his novels. But
he's not a man for whom the stars have aligned, really, is he?
No, it's not the most auspicious start. But he really loved reading. He devoured books. He knew very early on, he was very clear about where he felt his destiny lay. And in some ways, his father's death, though it might have caused him kind of guilt, it certainly freed him up to pursue what he knew he wanted to. He sat there writing a novel basically in penury. He couldn't afford to. All the money that he was supposed to have set aside for buying new boots he spent at the library and also billiards rooms and things like that. He was always terrible with money, but he wrote this novel, Poor Folk, and that propelled him straight to fame in Russian literary circles pretty much overnight.
So he was using his personal experience to actually develop the themes in that book, the gambling and the financial decline.
That Poor Folk was set in, it was kind of across a court, there was like a love story across a courtyard, a young woman who had been sort of abandoned a bit by her family, and an old man who, administrator, who kind of could barely afford, couldn't really afford to have, to offer his hand in marriage to anyone, but he was trying to sort of help her out because he loved her. And it's kind of a doomed love story set in this echelon of Russian society no one was really writing about at that time. And that was part of the reason why it was picked up so quickly. This famous critic called Belinsky saw it, and he immediately recognized that, you know, this was the sort of social realist novel that he'd been desperately hoping someone would write about Russia. You know, it wasn't a book about the gentry. This was a book about people who were struggling to get by in the heart of the city. These real lives that weren't being captured in literature up to that time.
Just a quick one. Who would have been reading Poor Folk? Is it a fair assumption that if we sort of categorise them as gentry and serfs, that serfs themselves would not have had the access to this literature, and it was a gentry occupation reading?
Yeah. Literacy was not widespread at all. It, you know, if you had an education, then it you know, it was because you were one of that class of people. The gentry was kind of broader in some ways than you know, it is in contemporary England. You know, it's not a few hundred people, but it's a tiny proportion of the Russian public. You know, you had kind of a population, I can't remember off the top of my head, but I think let's say it's around sort of 3 million people, and you had a few thousand really in the intelligentsia who were from these famous families who were kind of running the show. So it was about talking to the other liberal gentry. People would subscribe to these thick monthly journals that were kind of as thick as books. And that was really one of the big ways that people could conduct their public life. You know, the journals were almost the equivalent of, like, you know, Twitter and the news for us. It was where all of these public conversations were happening, and fiction was a huge part of that.
So when Poor Folk came out, this surfaced something that, against the backdrop of change, it surfaced a whole new tranche of ideas then about how
lived. It was really about showing what life was really like in Russia, kind of almost getting over the, there'd been a period of sort of romanticism and then these kind of fun, slightly absurd stories by Gogol, which did start to deal with people who were a bit downtrodden, but mainly as figures of fun, really. They, you know, things didn't end well for them, and it was all done in a kind of, and then he died lol, that was essentially like the ending of most of the Gogol stories. So it's, you know, this was something that hadn't really come. Its time had come, but no one had really written that book yet. And that was what this critic Belinsky was really excited, because he felt this was a new episode in Russian literature.
It was completely different. Nobody had tackled this before. The difference was that he was writing in a different way. Yeah.
Mm. So he got into that circle, that this kind of literary salon that had developed around Belinsky, and annoyed them all surprisingly quickly, and didn't write a follow-up that they liked. He wrote a sort of slightly more Gogol-style kind of absurd thing that they were all like, oh, what the hell is this? And so he fell out with them in about, I mean, so to give you some context, Poor Folk was published in January of 1846. The Double, this follow-up, was published in February. By that time, he was already falling out with them. So his period of literary stardom was really quite brief. Yeah, in his youth. He had a comeback, as we know.
So part of the problem with, well, being different and breaking boundaries and expanding literary views is encouraging people to think. Perhaps it becomes much harder for the powers to be to ensure consistency of subservience, order, and that led to him being arrested for belonging to a literary group that discussed banned books. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so after he'd fallen out with this Belinsky circle, and he got invited to a different circle that was, you know, pretty much the same on the surface. It looked pretty similar. It was kind of, you know, liberals drinking wine and chatting about things that they couldn't, you know. The nice thing about these literary salons was they would happen around someone's house. You know, it wasn't something you weren't going to get arrested for talking about. What do we do about the serfs? Because it wasn't a part of the public conversation. It was behind closed doors. But this group was much more kind of overtly challenging the way that things were run. And one of the things they did, they had one of their dinners where they would, you know, they'd get drunk and someone would start playing the Marseillaise on the piano and they'd all have lots of fun. One of these dinners, Dostoevsky stood up and he read a letter out that had been banned from Belinsky to Gogol, basically talking about we really need to solve this problem, you know, governments getting stuck. We need to solve this problem and liberalize government. We need to free the serfs. And he was kind of accusing Gogol of not writing about these important things. Just for reading out that letter, it turned out, you know, everyone thought they were safe at this private dinner, but actually one of the people at the dinner was an undercover police agent. So he was arrested and put in a fortress and interrogated a lot. And eventually he was subjected to a sort of grisly mock execution on a public square and sent to Siberia.
Gross. I mean, just mentioning to the fact that I think literary salons should make an immediate comeback. Because idea of hunkering down in somebody's front room with a couple of bottles of wine, hang on a minute, I think this is called Down the Pub on History Hack. What we do is we get together with a couple of bottles of wine and go, yep, let's explore these ideas and just rip them to pieces and come back again. But we don't always have undercover policemen in the room, not to my knowledge anyway. But you said that there was a mock execution. He was sent to Siberia, is that right? What would that have been like?
It was so the mock execution was, you know, it wasn't just a case of going through the motions. They lined them up. There were six of them there. He was number five, and they tied the first three to posts, put a big wood, a white hood over their eyes, lined up a firing squad. You know, they told them effectively they got to the point where they'd cocked their rifles, and then a man read in. Rode in galloping on a horse straight from the Tsar's palace with a note saying that he'd granted them their lives. But it was, you know, they waited until the very last moment. These people were pretty much as certain as a person could be that they were going to die.
So,
and that was obviously incredibly traumatizing.
Psychological abuse. I mean, was there a purpose to it?
It was an example. He was, he was really scared about these 1848 revolutions.
Right.
He was worried that he might lose his grip on the liberal intelligentsia. Mm-hmm. So he picked a bunch of people who looked like, you know, they might cause trouble in future and decided to make an example of them. One of them was Dostoevsky. So he was sentenced to 4 years hard labour. He was in a prison in Omsk where it was routinely minus 40 degrees Celsius, and all they gave him was a sort of like a sheepskin jacket. One of the descriptions he gives of his time in prison is that there was glass, you know, small glass windows in the barracks, but the ice on them on the inside of the glass was an inch thick. This was not a particularly comfortable experience, you know. He's got this incredibly Dantean, disgusting description of what the bathhouses were like, with this sort of sludge all over the floor and people, you know, people's change getting tangled up, and it's just honestly like a vision of hell. And that, you know, hard labor consisted at that time of breaking up timber, pounding alabaster, doing kind of very, very menial manual work. And the vast majority of the people there were the peasant class, who wouldn't give him the time of day. The irony is he was in there for trying to sort of liberate them. But they, as far as most of them were concerned, he was one of the, you know, one of the upper class that were part of the problem. So he had a pretty miserable time.
I'm surprised he survived. I mean, you're just describing all of this and all that's going through my head, because obviously I work in the Second World War. So all I'm thinking is gulag, gulag, gulag. And I'm surprised he survived such hard menial labor. It's unbelievable he's managed to get through it.
And he did spend, I mean, he spent some of the time he was there in hospital. I think part of the reason that, part of what made it really hard was the lack of adequate nutrition. Knowing he survived it, it's easy for me to sort of play it up in the book and he kind of makes a bit of fun out of it almost when he writes about it. But, you know, they'd have this sort of vegetable soup and the only protein really was these little black cockroaches that found their way into it. And you could, if you could get hold of money, which was by no means certain, you might be able to buy a bit of beef to eat every now and then, but basically you were just given gruel and then sent out into the cold to break up barges.
It's horrific. And for somebody who was clearly of a creative bent, who had a literary mind, whose imagination was always wanting to pour out onto a page, the deprivation of culture of anything must have been in some ways not worse, but a compound factor in actually his imprisonment and his exile there. So let's bring him out of exile. He comes back to writing, doesn't he? But he doesn't necessarily come back to having a wonderful, rosy life.
No, he had to spend, after you get out of your hard labour, you don't go straight back into society. You're still in Siberia, and he had to be a private in the army. Having already previously been an officer engineer. So the only real bright spot, I mean, he had a pretty terrible time there. He was officially not allowed to write at that time, but he did meet a woman he fell in love with. He'd actually met her through her husband at the time. She was married to a drunken excise officer called Isayev.
Scandal.
It was very scandalous, and they had my favorite little tryst that they had was he got posted somewhere else, so she was going to go, you know, hundreds of miles away, and on the night they were going to leave, him and his mate kind of they knew the husband liked to drink, so they brought basically unlimited champagne, waited until he was knocked out, and then they had a sort of a bit of a parting moment under the tree before they sort of hefted the husband back in the carriage.
Oh, no.
Dangerous. Really dangerous.
Yeah, yeah.
Dangerous isms.
Very saucy. But they eventually, Isayev was in very bad health, and he died, unfortunately. He spent a long time kind of chasing after her, and she wouldn't marry him till he got promoted and so on. Eventually, they did get married. They didn't make each other very happy, even from the wedding night basically onwards. He had an epileptic fit on his wedding night, and she was furious with him for not having been completely candid with her about his health. And I think they probably, the happiest that they were was during the chase, and then at the point where they were married, they almost began to realize that they'd made a mistake. But
Life comes full circle. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's often the case. And he represented this, didn't he, in Crime and Punishment? No,
There's a book called Injured. Yes, that's right. Insulted and Injured, there's this sort of love triangle. And so when she moved to this other town hundreds of miles away, there was a teacher there called Vergunov, who was totally stupid by all accounts, but really nice and quite hunky and younger and healthier than Dostoevsky. She would have had, you know, just as little kind of prospects with him, but I think they kind of got on pretty well. And there's this bizarre sort of 3 or 4 months where Dostoevsky's trying to coach Vergunov out of marrying Maria because it would be very bad for both of them. And you suspect he has a slightly ulterior motive here, but it's the whole thing has this kind of weird codependency going on. This bit of his life was like it reads like a novel. It's just love triangles all over the place.
So she's not she's not his only love interest. There's three women in your book. Can you tell us about Polina, not Elena, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, Polina and Anna?
Yeah, so when he eventually got back to St. Petersburg, he was allowed to resume his literary career. And what, you know, one of the things that actually made him kind of famous again, really, was this thinly veiled memoir of his time in prison called Notes from the House of the Dead. And he, at this point, Maria was very ill. She had consumption, and it was pretty clear she wasn't going to live very much longer. And by that point, as I say, they were kind of estranged already. His star was rising, and he'd become a bit of a hero to this young generation of students who were coming through, who were really looking for heroes who had. You know, Russia was beginning to liberalize. So this was the time of the new Tsar that we were talking about. And people were looking for people who had actually sort of basically stood up for what they believed in the previous period. And Dostoevsky had obviously, you know, suffered the last 10 years of his life for his beliefs. So, you know, ideas were really life and death to Dostoevsky. That's why it feels like that in his writing sometimes. And one of these students was a young woman called Polina, who was very forceful and outspoken and also beautiful and flirtatious, and they very much hit us off. He published one of her stories in his journal, and they kind of went from there. She was really insistent that he marry her, and he didn't want to divorce Maria in her dying months, which I think is fair. But he agreed to meet her in Paris that summer. Unfortunately, he was kind of waylaid by some business arrangements and paying back a loan. And by the time he got there, she had fallen in love with a Spanish medical student called Salvador. So didn't end well, Polina.
Oh, bless. Never mind, eh?
Yeah,
I know. Never mind, eh?
This is what happens when you...
Plenty more fish in the sea. Sorry, that's what I was trying to say.
Not many more fish in the tree.
No. So that was Polina...
Yes, that was Polina. Okay.
And the third woman who appears in your book is Anna. Now,
yes.
So now, one of these women actually sort of works in tandem with Dostoevsky, doesn't it, to ensure that his legacy is possible, that his literature can survive, even though people are still a little bit critical of it. And one of the other women, you have to explain which way around it is. One of the other women is involved with plan to assassinate the Tsar. Have I got that right?
So that was Polina. Polina was super interested in all these ideas of, like, you know, bubbling around socialism and what they called nihilism at the time, which is basically a sort of, you know, atheist socialist utopia and that kind of thing. And one of the days when they were very disconsolate and she'd found out Salvador was cheating on her and she was having a bad day, and she sort of looked out across the Paris rooftops and said, you know, I had a very dark thought the other day. And Dostoevsky eventually wheedles out of her. He thinks, oh God, she's thinking she's going to stab Salvador or something like that. She goes, no, all men are the same. If I'm going to kill anyone, why not kill the Tsar? You know, he's as bad as the rest of them. And that was pretty much, you know, bearing in mind that Dostoevsky had spent the best years of his adult life in Siberia for saying a lot less. I think that he was very, very freaked out of this and didn't take it very well.
But it's an indication, isn't it, that we've moved in a period of what, maybe 20, 25 years from a point at which the concept of changing society and actually removing serfdom as a concept has matured into an environment in which people now feel they can express that kind of sentiment, even if it's behind closed doors.
Absolutely.
It's a hockey stick of change in the way that they are living and the way that their views are being put onto paper. So Dostoevsky's writing reflects that, doesn't it? The way he starts writing his first titles reflects the fact that we need change, and then he goes through a period of change is happening, and then if we look at the end of his legacy, some of his writing is very reflective about the potential now that we can afford to stand up, we can survive, we can have been through that experience in Siberia, and we merit coming to the table and now discussing our own future.
Yeah, I mean, he saw huge potential in the throughout his life. Even in his older years, he was absolutely fascinated by this young generation, and I think he really wanted to sort of channel the energy into positive change. And one of the things he was terrified about was that it might somehow falter by going off course, by people being kind of seduced by dangerous ideas about, you know, Crime and Punishment is a story about a young student who thinks he's completely figured out all these theories about the world, and then he's done all the maths and he's realized, okay, if I just beat this old woman over the head with an axe, I can make the world better. And sort of according to his equations, that should be correct. But just on a human level, it doesn't work, you know? There's no, the problem with that, with these, you know, utilitarianism in this case, the problem is that it doesn't take into account humans and human feeling and compassion. And he sort of, you know, Dostoevsky's coming from a position as a, you know, as a Christian. I think that he felt that what was missing from some of these ideas was a sense of fellow feeling and you know, brotherhood. So that he really wanted to engage with this generation, and I think he wanted to sort of channel it towards a happier society and away from what he saw as the kind of coming violent revolution, which unfortunately he was then correct about. Didn't happen in his lifetime, but it did happen.
So, I mean, let's look at that society then. Because he, in the latter stages of his life, he wasn't very well. I think possibly on your website, you or one of the reviews of the book, there's a list of everything he was suffering from. This was not a well guy. How he ever got up in the mornings and went, I'm going to write really well today. I have no idea. Bladder infections, emphysema, hemorrhoids, epilepsy, you name it, poor Dostoevsky. But in being mentally prepared to write, and as writers, we know that some days there are some days when you just don't write really well. But the quality of what he was writing, certainly as he matured, it's revered now in some regards. What kind of environment was he having to write in? Can we imagine him in a dark, you know, rooftop study writing away? By hand, you know, I put my hands on the keyboard then, writing by hand, or was he on a chaise longue writing? What kind of environment was he creating these titles?
When it came to Crime and Punishment, you know, there's a scene where Raskolnikov hasn't eaten for ages and he's kind of getting delirious and keeps seeing things that aren't there, and he's in, you know, famously in his garret, you know. It's a brilliant scene, very evocative, like oddly lifelike. And the reason is, he wrote part of that while he had gambled away all his money in Wiesbaden. He didn't know anyone in the city. You know, he was basically going out at 3 p.m. from his hotel room every day and like basically hiding the fact from the hotel staff that he hadn't eaten. I think he went 3 days just drinking tea. And you know, they were getting increasingly annoyed and wouldn't press his shirts because he wasn't paying his hotel bill. And he was kind of sending letters off to increasingly sort of distant acquaintances to try to get some money off someone. You know, he even sent a letter to Polina, having kind of already fallen out with her. He sent a letter to Alexander Herzen, the socialist guy exiled in London who he'd met like once. I mean, it was really, really awful. So that's why, you know, that kind of comes through so strongly in Crime and Punishment. Later on, I mean, after he met Anna, who became his second wife, they had a period where they were basically debt exiles in Europe. If he went back to Russia, he'd just be chucked in prison. So he was kind of moving around Europe and gambling a lot. And they had a less stable life than they'd have liked, but it wasn't hand to mouth in that way. He still had a bit of income from his writing, but that was kind of while he was writing The Idiot. And then his last couple of books, actually, in the last few years of his life, he was super popular. They started publishing their own editions of his popular works that he'd already done. He had a monthly journal of his own called A Writer's Diary, which he was publishing directly to his, you know, direct to consumer kind of thing. It was really innovative at the time and incredibly popular. So by the end of his life, you know, he was doing pretty well by all accounts. And, you know, he went from being I don't know if he's the only person ever, but he's the only person I've come across who went from being a Siberian convict to being invited to dine with the Tsar at the end of his life.
That's no mean feat. What?
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm jumping forward here slightly. Where do we get this account of the dinner from? There must be a record of that somewhere.
Yeah, he. So basically, he got introduced to a guy called Pobodonostsev, who was tutor to the Tsareviches, the young.
You get an extra point if you can spell that, by the way.
If you can spell it in Cyrillic, then you're basically a scholar. But he was this guy was sort of super conservative and actually really, really enjoyed Dostoevsky's novels and thought there was great wisdom in them. He loved the way he was kind of blending Christian traditions with Russian traditions and thought that he had a lot to teach the young, you know, tsars to be, basically, and the grand dukes. So he brought him in really to sort of meet with them and be a bit of one of the many people in the court who was kind of providing a bit of a moral education to them, I suppose. But he wasn't very good at observing court etiquette. So he would kind of just chat to the Tsar as if he was another person without giving him the official names and things. He forgot to do that thing where you back out of the room and don't show them your back. There was one time where he was talking with a young Tsarina and he was making a point. He was so keen to make his point and for her not to get away. He was sort of talking at her. And he didn't have the best social graces at the best of times, but this one's particularly bad. He's sort of talking at her in this kind of blizzard of speech. And at the end of it all, she was kind of slightly crying and he realized that he'd been holding on to her coat button the entire time. He'd been basically grabbing her by the coat, which is not really what you're supposed to do with the royals. But he got away with it because he was Dostoevsky.
It's not hard to make friends and influence people, is it? But this isn't unusual for, and I'm going to make a huge generalism here that I don't, yeah, I'm confident about this one. Social skills for writers, for authors, it's not something they're known for. So if we think about the way that the imagination ends up being poured onto the page, it's often at the cost of those people having not being socially inept, but there's a refined element of their character that perhaps isn't as, you know, geared to, oh, I've got to spend 25 minutes talking to somebody nicely now.
Well, I suppose, you know, the really good writers, the people that we think of as reaching that standard of literature, is all about actually challenging the way that we live our lives, challenging society and social norms and the way things have always been done. Should we inherit that uncritically? But I think, you know, niceties are about observing those social norms. So in some ways, I guess it's not surprising. And there's a really good quote in Crime and Punishment, which to the effect that anyone who thinks up a new idea is effectively a criminal, because by creating a new condition, but a new law, you're violating the old one. You know, if you think about something like serfdom, you could look back in the 1860s and say, oh yeah, of course, abolish serfdom. 10 years before that, it was a crime to say so. So actually, you don't necessarily, society doesn't necessarily reward you for being an innovative thinker or for being ahead of your time. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, you know, today's heroes are yesterday's criminals.
Oh, I like that. Today's heroes are yesterday's criminals.
I should write that one down.
Yeah, you and me both. Okay.
So on this podcast, we are sticklers for talking about sources and where you actually go and do your research. We absolutely love to hear this kind of stuff. I mean, how far did you have to go to find these sources? And what kind of sources did you end up using for this?
I built the book out of mainly primary sources. So if you look in the note in the citations of my book, it's mainly Dostoevsky's letters, his complete letters, his novels, and then contemporaneous sources like Anna, his second wife, wrote. She wrote a set of memoirs that were kind of totally authorized and kind of published and palatable, but she based them off of some shorthand diaries she'd taken at the time, kind of day by day, which were a bit more candid and took ages to decipher because the type of stenography she used to use is like, no one does it anymore. So they were this kind of cryptographic mystery for a long time. So things like that, there's a really, really great book, which I'd recommend to anyone who's studying Dostoevsky in the UK, called The Dostoevsky Archive by Peter Sekerin, which gathers together loads of little bits of oral history, bits of testimony that might have been missed elsewhere. Some of it is things that are kind of quite well known. Other bits, I found an account in there that I just absolutely love. I was trying to find a good example of, because it's clear when you research Dostoevsky how much he loved his children. But just to say so is kind of dry, and I wanted to find a good example of his love in action, you know. And there's a great account in there of him playing this game where he put all his children on little stools and tell them they were on ice floes, and he dressed up as a polar bear. And he would, you know, he was going around the living room on all fours, threatening to gobble them up. And it's just lovely. And I haven't seen that account in another book. Yeah, it's really lovely.
It gives us a real insight to him as it gives us an insight to him as a human being, somebody who's actually really quite sensitive in a way to interaction. This is clearly a book that reveals something not just about the person but also about the man inside the man, his ability and capability to create literature. And even if we think that Dostoevsky's titles are a little bit hardcore, I think that a lot of our listeners would very much enjoy reading your book because it will help them to understand the author as well as the literature that he actually brought into the world. So thank you very much for joining us today. Tell us what's next for you. Is there something else on the horizon?
It's not the obvious next step for on paper, but I'd love to write about Cyprus. It's where my dad's from. It's a fascinating island, and it kind of sits at the intersection of so much interesting history because it's obviously the kind of meeting point between three different continents. So that's going to be my next big project.
That sounds very interesting. I do hope you'll come back and talk to us about it, even in mid, you know, while you're halfway through it, if you find out that you're exploring different avenues of the way different parts of history came together. We'd love to hear more about it, Alex.
Yeah, I'd love to. Thank you so much.
That's all right. Thank you. It's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Ladies Cheers. And gentlemen, don't forget to head towards our bookshop and you'll be able to grab a copy of Alex's book. Thank you so much.
You can help us at History Hack by joining us via Patreon. It takes quite a lot of effort and a lot of work of quite a big team now to keep us going. And so if you could donate as little as £3 a month, it would be massively appreciated by all of us. There's different levels because Princess Marcus has set it all up with varying rewards and things. So do have a look, do join us. There's an exclusive Facebook group as well, and you could be part of all of it.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, The 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them, and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/hackhistory, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.